When Weak Ties Are Strong. Decades of statistical research have demonstrated that professionals need to think elastically about the people in their idea networks. For example, repeated studies have shown that the longer a project team stays together without significant changes in its composition, the less likely it is to come up with ideas that lead to innovations. This is largely because members of long-running teams get into the habit of culling their ideas from a narrow band of sources, one another. They're less likely to communicate with people working on other projects and in other departments, and professionally through other channels outside the organization. They're less likely to come up with fresh solutions to problems. People on your team would fall into the category of strong ties, meaning that you and they belong to overlapping networks of information and ideas. Someone in a different specialty altogether would count as a weak tie, as this person normally travels in a different set of circles, organizationally or professionally. Part of achieving real diversity is to understand the strength of weak ties, which is the title of a 1973 paper by the American sociologist Mark Granovetter. Granovetter laid out a seminal social networking theory that remains highly influential today. He showed that the most valuable information comes from outside a person's usual network of contacts, through weak ties. He based his finding on interviews with hundreds of job seekers. They were far more likely to land a job through a weak acquaintance than through a friend, relative, or coworker with whom they shared the same connections. The strong tie contacts ordinarily spoke to roughly the same people that the job seekers spoke to, so they had more or less the same leads to offer. In professional life, some of the best ideas will come from weak tie individuals, whose conversational networks are different from ours. They may well have an entirely different perspective on a subject, one that expands our supply of knowledge and ideas. People like that are very important to idea hunters. They are customers, acquaintances, and many others, including perfect strangers. They do not fit easily into conventional notions of where and from whom to get expert opinions because they're not experts. That's not their function. Their role is to say things you might not otherwise hear, spark thoughts that otherwise might not come to mind. What they provide is not a substitute for expertise. It is a supplement. For example, if you're getting into the beer business, you'll naturally want to learn from beer distributors, wholesalers, marketers, and others in the know. But don't forget to talk to the guy sitting on the bar stool next to you. That's what Jim Cook did one day in 1984 after walking into a bar at Faneuil Hall in Boston. "I was doing market research," Cook recalled, with a laugh, because he had really walked into the establishment in need of a drink. But his thirst did not stand in the way of his hunt. At the time, he was already toying with the notion of starting a small craft brewery. His family had been in the business for a few generations. And so, he grabbed a stool and began tuning in to his surroundings. He struck up a conversation with a fellow who was holding a Heineken and asked him why he was drinking that particular brew. "I like imported beer," the man replied. Then Cook asked him how he liked the taste, and the response was surprising, given his stated preference for imported brands. "It tastes skunky," was the response. Skunky is a beer term for spoiled. At least at the time, imported beers did not have a fresh taste, only in part because they had to travel long distances to the United States. Most of the imported brands also came in clear or green bottles. They still do for marketing appeal. But it was a problem because hops, the key ingredient, spoils with exposure to light. That's why beer has traditionally come in darker colored bottles, which shield the light-sensitive hops. It was not a problem, though, for Cook. It was an incredible opportunity. He describes the conversation in Faneuil Hall as his wow moment when he realized that he could succeed in the high-end beer market with a fresh-tasting beer. In other words, he could take on the imports, which accounted for just 5% of the American beer market at that time. Their whole business model was based on selling stale and skunky beer to Americans and trying to cover it up with this old-world imagery, Cook told us. As for the domestic brands, they too were often stale by the time they reached consumers, at least partly because they spent too much time in warehouses. The stranger at Faneuil Hall, a weak Thai contact, was a case in point. Evidently he was drinking Heineken for the image and prestige, even while thinking it had a spoiled taste. Talking to that man in that place, not to a wholesaler in a warehouse, was the spark of insight for Cook. He still had much to do along the way to developing his high-end product and carving out a market for it, and he would have to educate the public on the basic fact that beer is a highly perishable product. But he was well on his way. A year after the barroom conversation, Cook launched the Boston Beer Company, which is now, by far, the largest craft brewery in the United States.